Yes, you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. I am your host, Jeff Bryant, and this is Now We're Talking. Cliff Prang is a professional actor and comedian and amateur husband and father of three. He has been in love with making people laugh since birth and has a full menu of comedy options, including stand-up, improv, speaking, emceeing, and auctioneering. I first met Cliff in 2012 when we both participated in a stand-up comedy workshop, for which I recall receiving a dubious and incomplete tax receipt. I don't know if that applied to you as well, Cliff.
I got no tax receipt.
You didn't bother to ask.
I asked so many times.
Did you really?
Yeah.
I think we did talk about that at the time.
Because I can deduct that stuff.
It's a deduction.
Deduct.
I can tell you that since then, Cliff has been keeping busy with all of his many pursuits. And as you've already heard, he's here in the studio with me now. Welcome, Cliff.
Thank you for having me.
Do you remember that when we did that?
Oh, I remember. That was like a 6-hour workshop, and where we listened.
We were there all day.
We were there all day, and they talked a lot about his experiences.
Yes.
And then we got to do like 3 minutes of jokes, and then we shredded each other.
Yeah.
And then we supported each other with helping each other come up with new lines and stuff.
And I remember that we bonded in the context of that day and that workshop, but I think we also did bond in the context of desperately seeking a useful tax deduction, which was not forthcoming. It was probably a cautionary tale about what we could expect from the comedy world. It's interesting for me to see you 5 years later because in a way, it doesn't feel that long, and it has been 5 years, and now I look at the things that you're accomplishing and what you're doing, and there's so many different hats that you wear, and stand-up comedian is one of them, but I asked you recently what you've been doing out of all these things, what you do the most, and it's speaking, or emceeing.
Emceeing, yeah. It's probably what I do the most is the emceeing non-profit events, so fundraisers, emceeing fundraisers, which doesn't seem to be very lucrative, because you're like, they're not for profit, but no, you can charge them quite a bit of money. So.
Yeah, because there's always a budget for these things,
there's a budget, and then, you know, you...
They build that into the budget, accept the cost.
Some of these organizations are bringing in, you know, so much money, and it's great causes, and so then the treat for me, like the bonus for me, is I get to find out what these people are doing, and then I get to represent them. So
yeah,
I'm communicating their message, and then also while keeping things flowing and keeping it light and having a good time. Like, yeah,
it seems like when it comes to the role of the MC, from my experience witnessing it, it's so often overlooked its significance.
Oh,
like it's taken for granted that whoever is on the board or something will be the MC. And it's not really appreciated as like the influence it has on the flow of the evening. So is that true from your experience?
100%.
Yeah.
That's my selling. That's my pitch.
Right.
Is that, you know, you can get your board director, you know, your board chair to do it, but then, but then you're waiting to eat your food.
Yeah. You're just like, when is this over?
Yeah, exactly. So, but you know, and it's a lot of good intentions. Like these people, obviously they're involved in their organization, but that's the thing when you're so personally involved with what you're doing, you can't ask for money anymore. You really can't, because it's like you're asking in a way for money for yourself.
Yeah.
And so to have a third person come in there, and then again, like I said, you know, be fun and keep it moving, and then being able to even ask for money. That's one of the things I get to do sometimes is like, could you do the pitch? Could you do the ask? Could you show them the donation card? And that's fun. It's fun to do that, because especially as people respond to it, then it's, you know, you've been able to serve them, and that's a great honor.
What was the first time that you did this? When was the seed planted? Because for a lot of people, there's a lot of things that you do, and I feel like I have things that I've done in my professional life where people are like, how does that work? How do you get into that? So for you, what was the sequence here? Like, I know that when you grew up, you were doing theater and you were comfortable on stage and you have experience performing across the country doing improv. How did it lead to the role of MC?
At the very first event ever, the very first fundraiser, at least I think it's my very first event because it stands out so strongly in my mind, was the Cyrus Center in Abbotsford. Basically my very first solo gig ever.
Right.
Where I was hired to, I thought I was being hired to do the MC work.
Okay, right.
Yeah, I called the organizer and said, hey, could you send me the transitions, like what you want me to say? And then I will, you know, I'll figure out how to make it smooth and funny and all that stuff that I was just talking about. And he's like, no, you're not the MC, you're the entertainment. I'm like, what? And I'd never done, like, my whole background, high school and college, was like sketch and improv.
Yeah, script, or there's other people. You're not gonna do it alone. That's the challenge with whether it's stand-up
or
this.
Terrifying.
And you said, I think you told me before when I asked about this, you said 20 minutes?
Yeah,
that's a lot of time.
They gave me 20 minutes to do to do basically stand up. And I'd never, I'd up to that point, I've always wanted to try stand up, but I'd never done stand up before. Now, this was, of course, like it was like a conference room, people sitting around round tables, the lights were up. So it's not your standard comedy club,
right.
Which we could talk about later as being the most terrifying place to be in the world. You know, but yeah, so it was like these were very warm. They're all there. They're all very supportive crowds. So as a first place to do stand up, it worked out.
Because they want you to succeed.
They want you to succeed. They want to have a good time. And so when everyone's there because they want to have a good time and they want you to succeed, then it works out well, as opposed to arms crossed, make me laugh.
Yeah, here he is. Apparently he's a real funny guy. Cliff Frank, thanks for the intro.
Thank you.
Basically, as anybody who's done stand-up knows, is the kiss of death when you're introduced as being hilarious.
Well, and that was what Seinfeld's saying. It's like, don't introduce me as the funniest person ever because I don't want that expectation.
Everybody's going to sit there, oh, is he?
Yeah.
Prove it.
I know some funny people and I don't think you are that person.
Yeah, I don't think you lived up to my expectations.
No, not at all. So yeah, so that first event, so I did 20 minutes. I adapted stories and I wrote some jokes and whatever else, and it worked out well and I got paid. So my very first stand-up experience was being paid for something. But the thing that I asked for when I realized that I wasn't the MC, and it was there's such a huge safety net in knowing what the schedule is, because then you're just the material is in the schedule. I asked them for their auction. I'd never done a live auction before. I'm not an auctioneer. I don't talk fast.
Like the Micro Machine guy.
Yeah.
That's what people think of when they think of an auctioneer.
Elmer Fudd.
Yeah, we both just kind of fudded it up there.
That's it, because I can't.
Fudd Fest.
I can't even pretend to be an auctioneer. That's
we can just pretend vaguely to be Elmer Fudd in support of one another.
Exactly. But yeah, so then, they give you the items and the descriptions, and then you just go off your riff. And that's where I applied all my improv skills. And then, you get people bidding against each other. Yeah, and then the cool thing is then I was given the mayor to auction off the mayor. So now all of a sudden in my own city, I know the mayor well because I had him on stage and I auctioned him off. Like I basically prostituted the mayor, which
that's
was
a good way to get to know somebody.
Yeah, exactly.
Pretty intimately.
So, yeah. So and so that was just a fun thing where all of a sudden it's like, oh, I can do this. This is a lot of fun. And
it's the value of sink or swim, eh?
And I didn't market that. I ended up getting more gigs.
Because people knew that you'd done that, and they said, what about that Cliff guy?
Cliff guy, he does all right.
He's
pretty funny.
When you have so many career goals you're trying to pursue, to have one where your reputation precedes you, it almost must have felt too good to be true having people ask you to do it based on the strength of that one time.
Yeah. It's a great honor. And I was already, I used to tour doing improv, and I did that professionally. And so people knew me as the Panic Squad guy. I used to tour with a group called the Panic Squad. We did a lot of conferences and local events, and local being anywhere from Vancouver and then into, I had my visa at 1.2, so I was traveling throughout the States, and that was fun. So people knew, oh, there's the Panic Squad guy. And so then having that kind of on my resume at that time, that gave people the confidence that I could be funny. The thing that people didn't know is that I'd never really been funny on my own. So,
and it is different, right?
It's totally different.
Yeah,
yeah. You don't have those resources. And then all of a sudden you realize then though that you have your audience and my own life are all my improv partners, right? So then you've got all your life experiences. And I think with creativity, a lot of times it's you make something out of nothing. Or with improv, it's creating something out of nothing. It's like, well, that doesn't work because you're not nothing. You've got a whole wealth of experience and personality.
You
can draw upon that. That's your shtick.
There's all these different roles that you play. And of course, I can see the transferable skills between them, but they also are their own distinct version of expressing some of those performance skills. What do you think it is that underscores all of these roles that makes you, whether it's a situation where you're being thrown in and you might sink or swim, but ultimately you survive? Is it who you are as a person or the skills you've developed? What does it take for somebody, I guess, to be good at these different roles? Because you mentioned Jerry Seinfeld before, and I always think about the joke that he has about how people's number one fear is public speaking, number two is death. They'd rather be in the casket than delivering the eulogy.
Yeah.
And that's just public speaking.
Mm-hmm.
We're not talking about being funny. even if you're just talking about getting through it, it's people's number one fear. You add to that the obligation, the expectation to be entertaining or delightful to people. In a way, it really is people's worst fear. So I guess I'm curious about why is it people's worst fear, and why is it that you would be able to do it or would have sought to do it in the first place, something that's so scary to people?
Yeah, well, the thing is I didn't seek it out. You kind of all of a sudden learn that you are that person.
Right.
Right. And that was, you know, and as a kid, it came out as it was I don't know, coping skills, right? My parents are divorced, and so then as a child, I had sadness.
Happening to Cliff right now in the studio. I'm not sure what it is. I'm along for the ride, but he's degenerating into some sort of...
I just started thinking of what you did, Jeff. This is where it's all about...
Is it your inner voice?
It's all about authenticity right? So what I'm doing is I'm protecting my inner voice. I'm protecting my real self by putting out a funny voice.
Ever-thickening funny voice.
Oh, my gosh, because it's like I started feeling things, and so the one thing I don't want to do is, if I'm being honest, which what your hope is that we're having an honest conversation, sure. And I will be honest because I actually care to tell the truth, because if it can be benefit of someone, then that's a good thing. So,
certainly.
It was a defense mechanism for me, and it was survival as a diffuser. So a lot of tension in our home growing up, and so then it's like, I'll dance.
Right.
Like, he's like, I'll dance. I'm going to dance now. I'm going to, do the armpit fart. I'm going to expose myself. There's a lot of mooning that happened in my family.
In the house.
Yeah.
Is this to entertain your siblings or to, as you say, diffuse some of the tension?
Yeah, diffuse tension, entertain my mom, make her happy, whatever it was. I did those things. And then it realized that it's like, oh no, this is there's something. Like, I didn't go to school then and sign up for the talent show and show my bum to everybody. Though that would have been a sweet show.
It would have been quite the debut.
But I just learned that I loved it. And
you noticed how it made you feel.
Yeah. Well, I remember our church had a talent show, and I brought my joke book, and I just read jokes out of the joke book. And so maybe that was my first stand-up gig ever.
Okay.
It was just, it was just a way to kind of get through that. But you were saying something about like transferable skills what's the through line between all those things? I'd say, like you said, who you are, authenticity. For me personally, it is a desire to bring something to people, like to actually serve them, to give them a gift. Like, people come to a comedy show or, come to an event, and who knows what their day was like, who knows what their week was like, who knows what's going on in their life.
Yeah.
And it's also why I've chosen the style of comedy that I have, which is, pretty clean. I don't get too deep, politically or whatever else. I'm not really trying to challenge everyone's thoughts on everything. I just want to have a good time. And it's mostly self-deprecating. So I don't want to,
Which makes it accessible to people. When you're self-deprecating, you're not looking to pick on anybody.
Totally, totally. Yeah. And even if I have I've been doing some more clubs and bars, and you get the rowdy, or you get the person who's talking, you get the drunkard, and even though there's a little flash that goes off your brain, it's like, I want to shred this person until they cry.
Yeah. I will put them in their place.
I want to, if you can't choke them with your hands, you want to at least make them feel very bad about themselves and their actions.
And of course, stand-up comedy can really encourage you to be that person.
Yeah.
And you are kind of an outlier if you make the decision not to indulge in that, because I would say that is more par for the course. It's almost like for sport.
Yeah, and not everyone. There's a few comedies that are so good at it where I watch people get shredded, and I'm like, wow, that guy's a genius. The way he was able just to undress that person.
It's like playing an instrument or something.
It's unbelievable. But then at the same time, I don't want the person, like that person's lasting impression of me. I'd rather them just not remember the show because they were so drunk.
Yeah.
But I'll deal with it, obviously, but I'll try and be as positive as I can.
Yeah.
Because that's the thing. I want everyone to walk away having had a good time.
Yeah. Yeah. Who are some of the stand-up comedians that have influenced you along the way?
Oh, man. I love, this is the thing. Like, I'm a top 40s kind of guy. Like, mm-hmm. I love watching Mike Birbiglia. He's probably my favorite because he's a master storyteller.
Right.
And again, self-deprecating. And he just kind of weaves in and out of the stories and the jokes and his subtle act outs.
He had that movie, Sleepwalk With Me?
Sleepwalk With Me is a fantastic movie.
Yeah.
It's so slow. It's such a slow-paced film, but just you feel his personal angst as he's going through it, and I love that. So, yeah. And then he has his new special out, Thank God for Jokes, which is a bit more of an edgier thing because he's known as a clean comedian, and his whole thing is like his actual shtick is, people hire me because I was a clean comedian, and then I did the Muppet Show, and you got to watch it yourself. I'm not going to do it justice, but he forgot his stool coming out on stage, And he got on stage, and the first thing out of his mouth with children and Muppets was the F word. He's just like, F! And it was so good. And I laughed so hard because it was just like, that is a well-timed F-bomb. Like, that
right.
is the
it's
perfect,
very purposefully used.
Very purposefully. Yeah. But that said, I love watching Bill Burr, and I love watching Louis C.K., and they're not as positive. They're way more like political and issues-based and like yeah. ranty. But I also really enjoy that as a comedian, as a human being, to hear sure. people wade into some of those heavy issues and stuff like that. And maybe, who knows, as I mature, do more clubs and more bars, then that'll evolve more. But I don't want to be heavier, but at the same time I like poking fun at the things that people are looking at so weightily. I've got a little bit of stuff on racism and a little bit of stuff on, you know, on sexuality. Yeah. That's a little bit more pokey. Maybe I shouldn't say pokey and sexuality in the same thing.
You should think about using that in your future routine. It's like, as you're saying this, by the way, I'm conjuring up the image of like 30 years from now, you're known as being a vile, filthy, disrespectful comedian. Like, that's what you're not just known yeah. as, but you're like a legendary comic, and that's your thing.
That's my shit.
And then somebody excavates this podcast from 30 yeah. years in the past, and they're like, well, I guess he was at least suggesting it could happen, but man, did it ever start to happen
to be
for
honest.
Him.
I want to give people the fair
what
warning.
What a journey he's been on. My God.
I wanted my dad to know that it could happen.
What about older? These are like contemporary comedians.
Contemporary.
When you were a kid, are there yeah. any of the classic? I mean, obviously the classic comedians you always hear people talk about are Carlin and Pryor, and for me, maybe Bill Hicks or Steve Martin. Any of those guys or other guys of that era?
Well, I'm actually doing the Steve Martin masterclass right now.
What's that?
It's, well, a masterclass, you can go online and basically learn from pros. Like, you know, Kevin Spacey has an acting masterclass, and Gordon Ramsay is now doing a cooking masterclass. So you can okay. go online. It's like, you know, however many sessions. Like, this one's like 25 sessions, 10-minute chunks of him just talking about the craft, these various topics, whether it's your voice, whether it's your manifesto or what it is. And then he gives you homework to, you know, write jokes or write
is,
your manifesto.
Is it a video he's created, or is it a live feed? Or
no,
what is
no,
it?
It's not live. It's a video. It's a video videos. Series. Yeah, you watch these 10-minute series, and then there's a hub, and people are interacting with it. There's so many people interacting though.
Yeah,
I'm not interested in doing that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And how you say 25 sessions? How far into it are you?
I'm like seven in.
So what do you? So that's, let me do the math here. That would be 28%.
Oh,
not bad, eh?
Wow, Rain Man.
Yeah,
I am gonna drop some paper clips on the floor, and you tell me.
I'm just like, it's. I just my shtick is it's always 28%.
Oh, is that
you drop a bunch of paper clips? I'm just like 28%,
and that would be.
And
wrong.
You're like, I don't think that's accurate. I don't think this is a percentage based situation.
No.
So you're 28% in. We think.
Yeah.
What have you learned from Steve Martin so
well,
far?
Well, what I love about what, and this is what you're talking about, like, you know, what are your inspirations at older comics? He's a comedian that's not really like, he's not a stand-up comedian per se. He's more of a performance artist.
Yeah.
His manifesto, and I really love this, is identifying what your purpose is. And that's really helpful for anybody to know why it is you're doing what you're doing, because then that helps you select.
It's a great starting point.
Yeah,
right?
It's great. And so he said his thing was he wanted to make people laugh without telling any jokes. So he, you know, imagine him Madison Square Gardens, you know, with a 90-minute show, and he's not actually, you know, introducing topics and then and then dropping punchlines.
So he was conscious of this from the infancy of his career. This is my MO. I want to see if I can do this thing.
He wanted to do a satire his whole career. He
right.
wanted to do a satire
of a comedian. From like probably 20 years before. Like this is the 70s, so like 50s comedian
yeah.
or something.
Yeah. Totally, but then I've got some albums, some vinyls at home.
Yeah,
and so we had a record player. It's so much. Why do people do? It's so much work.
It's a lot more work.
It's a lot more, and then you got to flip it halfway through.
Yeah,
I bought a Monsters and Men album, which is great. But it's like, if I just downloaded an iTunes for $9 or whatever,
it's gonna play.
It's just gonna play, and now it's two records, and then they're brilliant pink records. But there's three songs on each.
It's a lot more work.
It's so much.
You're
work.
Putting in work.
Yeah. So I don't
the
listen.
Romance of
I
the
haven't listened. To all the vinyls that I own, but I listen to Bob Newhart's.
Oh yeah, Bob Newhart. Know? They're interesting.
Yeah, but they're just weird stories. Like, they're weird. Yeah. Like, not even a lot of jokes, just weird stories. And like, I loved his show, and I love some of his sketches. But listening to the stand-up, like, he's an amazing talent, and obviously has had this amazing history. But not for me.
Good examples of when people have their own voice. You know, you hear so much of that when it comes to stand-up, is finding their own voice. And I mean, Bill Cosby would be another example of that. It's a highly controversial person to discuss, but like he would be known. Like you mentioned the documentary Comedian, which came out in 2002, Jerry Seinfeld documentary.
Yeah.
And I remember him and Seinfeld and Chris Rock saying, I already did 3 hours, man. The thing is, it's like 3 hours of him just kind of using his voice.
Yeah.
Not feeling the pressure to have 3 hours of jokes or whatever.
Bill Cosby himself was probably the first stand-up comedy I'd ever watched. And I remember him doing his dentist bit, and my dad and I, like, I remember snot and tears. And there's a lot of snot and tears in my life anyway, but
anyway,
that was...
But even more so.
Me and my dad were laughing so hard, and that's what I like. I still love Bill Cosby's comedy. I don't love his...
You don't endorse his extracurricular activities?
And that's always the tragic thing, right? When you have someone
when
that
you love
idolize,
somebody and you realize
they're
imperfect.
Yeah, like when I'm 70 years old and I drop that, you know, that effing album, then everyone's like, oh man, I love that Cliff guy. And then he went off the rails.
Way off the rails.
Yeah. That Stabbing Babies album, that was just the worst.
Apparently it was like a reality album. It wasn't even like comedy. It was just literally,
just
he was in
the
studio
the
stabbing babies and it was captured on audio. That's way, way extreme.
Totally,
and arguably not even comedy.
No, not
just
anymore.
Just an illegal, immoral act.
Do you see how uncomfortable I just got? Like now my legs are crossed and my arms are folded.
Yeah, everything's collapsing inward. It's like if you could go into a fetal position on the floor, you would, but you feel it.
I would stab myself.
Exactly. You start stabbing yourself with some of those paper clips that we've scattered along the floor. I do think that is, I think 28% of the floor is covered in paper clips,
absolutely,
by the way.
In case we need, anyway.
Yeah. Do you ever do the open mic scene in Vancouver? I mean, was there a period when you did do that for a while?
Yeah, well, it's hard. I live in Chilliwack. So,
yeah, you got to do that commute for what, 3 minutes? So it's hard to justify that drive.
It's a long drive. Like, Chilliwack to Vancouver, that's an hour and a half.
Maybe that
here.
Drive has spared you a lot of unnecessary time doing
a lot
those
of
rooms.
Pain. But when this is, I went and I did an open mic at Vancouver Yuck Yucks.
Oh, yeah.
This is before I took that class with you.
Right.
Because, I did.
The Pro Am night or whatever.
Yeah, I had a successful like my very first paid gig. It went really well. People really enjoyed it. And then I did a few other things too that went really well. And then that's even before I'd ever done a comedy club spot. And so then I went in to Vancouver and I did I was given 5 minutes to tell jokes. And it was terrifying. I'd never been like, I don't remember a time where I was as frightened to get on stage.
Wow.
And I got up and I did poorly. I didn't do well. No, it was
as poorly as you worried that you would, or slightly better, but still not good.
No, I didn't. I'm sure people laughed at some things or whatever else, but I felt so not present.
Right.
I felt so...
You're just trying to get through it, just get the hell out of there?
Yeah, well, I wasn't trying to run away. I just wanted to feel comfortable. I never felt comfortable. And I think that's probably the best evaluation of how you did is like, do you feel like you were in the moment?
Yeah.
And or not? Did you have another story happening while you're there? And my story was... I'm so scared. I think I shouldn't have had that beer before I perform because I feel a little funny in my head. I don't know what was
going on. If you just took that inner voice and allowed that to be your 5 minutes.
You know what? I would have done
it. Been some experimental comedy that people might have enjoyed.
Might have been a lot better than what it was. Yeah.
That's interesting. So does that hold up as the most fearful moment you ever had before going on a stage?
I think that my first 5 minutes at Vancouver Yucks is probably one of the scariest things. And this is having done... professional corporate improv
with big expectations, big audiences,
absolutely,
big money, like there's a lot of things involved,
totally, and there was wins and there's like losses with that as well. Like the good gig and the bad gig and whatever else, but for just playing Fear Factor for something that didn't matter, it was a good learning experience. But what I find from all my losing experiences is that that's always the defining moment where it's like, do you actually really want to do well at this? And so with that, it's like, oh, that sucked, I hated it, I want to beat that. I want to beat that thing.
I want to improve upon that experience.
Totally. And so then I've been back. I've been to the Comedy Mix and I've done some other rooms in Vancouver. And over the last number of years, I still haven't come out. And there's the Yuck Yucks in Abbotsford now where I got a lot more reps in there. And then me and another guy, Yo, who runs the whole thing now, but he started it and I helped him get it going. He runs Fraser Valley Comedy out there. And so that's five bars in Chilliwack that host comedy once a month. And so I've gotten a lot. I've gotten, you know, hosting reps. I got headlining reps in there. I've got, you know, just the 5, 7 minute, 10 minute spots in there. And so over the last 2 years in terms of club and bars, I feel way like I'm equipped now. And so to be able to succeed in those rooms, then you take the sharpness that you're getting, you know, dealing with so many variables. You take the sharpness from being able to tell a joke with a distracted audience, or, you know, getting everyone on board by, you know, getting them ready for the next comic or whatever else, taking all those experiences and that skill set, and then taking that to the corporate stage. And now all of a sudden you're quicker and punchier.
Yeah.
And so then people who are used to, you know, having a boring award ceremony now are getting, you know, treated to some like fast paced, you know,
quick on your feet, polished,
you know, joke telling and transitions. And so that's the huge gift. That's what's making also some of the, you know, the corporate stuff work out so well, is because I'm getting the club chops and the bar chops. Yeah.
It always makes me think when I consider this sort of a scenario of when I was in Little League, and I realized at one point when I was on the on deck circle, if I swung 3 baseball bats, then when I went up and just swung 1 baseball bat, it would feel so light that my swing would be quite effortless and powerful and quick. And if I hit the ball, I was going to hit it a lot better because I was disciplined in all that extra weight, and then you cast it aside. So yeah, I also think of the same analogy when it comes to stand-up comedy, doing those open mic rooms and then getting into a actual paid comedy room. Because for me, when I met you 5 years ago and I was going through this experience as well, I probably did about 50 or so sets that year, like 3 to 5 to 7 minute sets at the open mic rooms, which, same thing with music, it's largely filled with other performers who are waiting to do their stuff.
Yeah.
And
who don't necessarily want to give you the validation.
Yeah,
you're not that funny, but you'll think I'm funny.
There's any number of reasons why it's not going to be the most warm or inviting room, and those are a couple of the reasons. So when it came time to do like the comedy mix or Yuck Yucks or something like that, I inferred, man, if this was hard, that's going to be even harder because the expectations will be higher. But it was actually the opposite. Like, once you get somebody warming up the crowd properly, they're having the comedy room experience of music playing, they're being seated, they're having drinks.
Yeah.
You realize, oh man, like audience context is everything, because these people are like ready to laugh. So if now I've done this 50 times and I know my jokes, my sequence, like I might see how it could be better, but you get these big warm laughs and you're going, oh, it's quite a bit better when the room is ready.
Totally.
Yeah.
And that's such a nice feeling, is to get that laughter. It's addictive.
Yeah.
Well, my very first, I was great.
Such a relief to get the first laugh, right? It's the first laugh.
They think I'm funny.
I'm going to be okay. I'm going to survive this.
Yeah. Well, and that's why having a good opener is key. Like having a quick, tight, you know, joke.
Set the tone.
Where you're going to get a laugh right away, because then, you know, then everything after that is going to hopefully come a little bit smoother. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. But how impressive. It's just impressive to me that you did 50 sets that first year, because, yeah, I would have probably that year, in terms of like coming into open mics and stuff, I might have gotten 10, you know, for the whole year in terms of that context.
Yeah.
And that's something like, man, the Vancouver scene is so fantastic, and there are so many incredible talent. And being in Chilliwack and having Vancouver comics coming out to Chilliwack to perform on the stages out there, I've been able to see some like so many funny people. And from the few times that I've come in to tell jokes, there's if you're listening and you're not going to Yuck Yucks and Comedy Mix and even like Laugh Lines in New West, but you've got all these other rooms, like you got the Kino Cafe, you've got Corduroy Comedy.
Is Goldie's still a thing?
Goldie's is now called, and this is such a brilliant name, Susie Rossum is running that in the basement. It's called the Bomb Shelter.
Okay.
Yeah, how great is that? The Bomb Shelter.
Pretty good.
Because it's in the basement, and then that's where you
that's
go.
That's where I would think to go if there's some sort of apocalyptic event, now that you've mentioned it.
Or if you think you might get an opportunity to hear a comedian struggle.
Totally.
You know, that's
yes, I get it now, the Bomb Shelter.
Oh, you didn't get it right away. No, it's good.
No, I just took it very literally. I'm a very literal person.
Well, it's dangerous times right now. Like, who knows what's
exactly
happening?
Yeah, exactly.
No, nukes are flying. And
yeah, anything's possible.
Yeah.
The Bomb Shelter, where comedians go to bomb, but hopefully not for too long.
No. Well, that's actually, it's a funny thing when it comes to going to amateur nights, like sometimes audience members are there specifically to enjoy the anxiety of watching people go down. It is perverse.
How perverse and yet inspired at the same time. That is an inspired choice.
Because you need those audience members there because, again, they keep the rooms going. So it doesn't matter what your motivation is. Just fill up a seat, and then you might be surprised with some. But, yeah, no, Vancouver's got a thriving scene, and it's fun to see how much amazing. And then the success of a lot of like guys who are recording albums. You got, you know, Kevin Banner. You got Ivan Decker just put out albums. And these are very, very funny comics.
And again, coming back to all the roles that you play, like, is stand-up comedian the preferred, or do they all kind of offer their own reward? I mean, one thing we haven't yet talked about is I know that there's also the element of inspiring people. I know that you go to schools. I had the impression, I don't know if this is right, but maybe some groups outside of the school setting, maybe a corporate environment or something, but going into groups, helping them to be creative as well. Are these just different facets of who you are and you enjoy giving each of them expression?
Yeah, I enjoy all of the things that I get to do, and people give me a hard time a bit, you know, say you got to focus on one, and
right.
But then I'd be bored.
I hear that, man.
I do, like, I love stand-up, and like stand-up is the newest thing that I've done. It's the thing that I have, I have like a growing amount of experience. It's what I've been doing a lot over the last, you know, especially the last 2 years, and then incorporating my last Christmas season, like I did a lot of just show up. After dinner, tell 30, 45 minutes of jokes and then get my check and go, you know? And so that there's a lot of like, that's a fun thing. And to be able to, you know, give people a little bit of a hard time and, you know, poke at the boss a little bit but then also honor the whole event and say, hey, how cool is it? You got a boss that puts on a party for you. You know, that's called pandering. You need that moment.
And hitting the mark in terms
exactly.
of why you've been hired, right?
Exactly.
So that you can get hired again.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, and that's the nice thing when you get hired again. And that's like with the MCing, you could get hired year after year after year.
Right.
Because it's like, it's not, you do a stand-up set and then it's like, you probably won't do that gig next year, nor do you want to, because I'll tell you something, I'm not going to write 45 minutes of jokes.
This
it's
is
not,
my set. I've done it for this group of people. But when you're an MC, it can be an annual
as long as you keep your notes, you guys, you know, save your files on your computer and then look to see what you did last year. And even if you did some of the same stuff, it's like people might be happy to hear it again, because this is an important thing for all comics to realize, is that people forget jokes. You know, and it's like there's some comedians that I've listened to over and over and over again, and I'm still surprised by their punchlines, or I get excited for the punchlines if I know it that well. Like it's just that, it's that a good thing. But anyway, I try to keep it fresh for those MCing gigs.
Yeah.
So MCing, great, I love it. Stand up, I love it. Improv is the thing that I've done the most for the longest amount of time that isn't as fresh and fun for me as it used to be.
Because you did it professionally
for such a long time.
Yeah.
And it's not like it's the safest, the easiest form, I find.
Right.
Because again, I have that support. What makes it fun for me now is me and my brother-in-law do it.
I've seen
so,
that.
Yeah.
Hold on, it's your wife's sister's husband.
Yeah.
So they're sisters.
Yeah.
And each of you married one of the sisters.
We married a sister.
And did you meet, what was the context for you meeting him? Did you know him before all this marriage happened?
I met him because he started dating my sister-in-law.
Right.
Right? And then he was like, he's super nice. He was a super nice kid. Right? He was like a nice kid. And then he went to UFE and got his theater degree. And I just had an opera. We did a prison show. Me and my friend who I used to tour with doing professional improv. He's like, hey, what do you think about Steven? It was him. It was his idea. He's like, what about Steven? Why don't you get Steven to come and do this prison show with us? We were just doing a pro bono thing at this, you know, at this prison. And so he came and did it. And he was the most selfless improviser I'd ever performed with. And this is because my buddy Dave Swan, if you're out there in Edmonton listening to this via the internet, he loves to screw his fellow players. Like he loves to block and he loves to force them into characters they don't want to play. That's called pimping, where it's like, mom, mom's like, I don't want to be your mother, but it's too late. He already called for the mom. He's like, I'm a mom. Or he's like,
I come in, dear?
And I'm talking in a, you know, I'm talking as a, you know, a manly man. He's like,
painting people into a corner is his passion.
He does it. He loves it. And I watch
him. The rule of improv is, as you say, if you're selfless, it means that you're creating lots of space.
So it was like watching repeated spikes, you know, and a volleyball player just continually digging them out of the dirt. And I saw Steven get pimped and blocked over and over and over again for sport. And he just kept, he yielded and yielded, and he like dodged and jumped, and he did every single thing. He didn't miss a single challenge. And I was like, oh my gosh, I want to do way more stuff with my brother-in-law because he's so good. And because he is so giving, I could drive an entire show and never have to yield.
The best of both worlds.
No, but it's great. So we do stuff together, and we don't do a ton, but every time we do it, our last show that we did was in January, and it was an accountant's year end or year starting party. And again, we did like a 45-minute show, and you get the bosses up on stage, and we had a blast. So that's fun. And all our material comes from all our work comes from our Thanksgiving dinners, making fun of my father-in-law. So
it's nice to have all these options available, as you say, to have some variety. I mean, that's
a menu.
A point well taken for me. It's definitely in my life. I'm looking to have there's multiple things I enjoy, but I want to have that variety to keep everything fresh. And I can see why people there'd be a school of thought that dictates you got to pick one thing and master that thing. For example, my good friend Chris, who was on the show a few weeks ago, he's a masterful guitar player. Mm. And he had different things in his life that were capturing his attention. And he discussed how important it was for him to isolate the one thing he wanted to experience mastery with. So it's a point well taken. But yeah, if there may be all expressions of the same underlying desire, it's okay for it to be expressed in different ways. Maybe you having different songs that you've written. You know,
right,
what I mean?
Right, right, right. Yeah. Yeah, no, I can hear that, especially with music. It's also about longevity, you know, whether you get bored of doing something, but also to be able to have options for people to book you, right?
Yeah.
So it's like if you're in there doing, again, you're doing a gig as a stand-up comedian, then if those same organizers enjoyed working with you and they know that you could do an improv show, and this is how I'm going to market is I will market the improv show to the people who hired me for stand-up, and for the people who hire me for improv, I market the stand-up, right?
It's so true. It's so actually it's advantageous, like, from a business standpoint,
you
because you're saying
things.
Tell me what you need and maybe I can offer you the service that you require.
And those are the conversations. It's like, how can I serve you? Like, one-stop shop, you know, you can come and
we're already talking. You might as well talk to me about that thing.
And even if I don't have what you're looking for, I can find it for you. And so this last year I did four shows with a good friend of mine who's a DJ. So it's like, I hear people have a dance. I'm like, well, who's your DJ? Well, we worked with this one guy. He's like, yeah, but my buddy, he's really good at this. And is like, and you guys, he's less expensive, and you know, and we have chemistry, so we can do a thing together. So I do some interactive
dance
stuff.
He got his criminal record expunged last year, so technically
he's
never
good.
Committed a crime
exactly.
In the eyes of the law.
Exactly.
That's an exciting thing that happened last wedding season.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's talk about the inspirational stuff. Let's talk about the going into schools, how that came about and what that means to you to be able to... Because I have some experience with that as well, going to schools performing. I used to do that through an organization called Art Starts. And yeah, it meant something to me to be in there. But for you, it's a more overt experience of going in and, I guess, talking about your own life experience, talking about bullying, things like that.
Yeah,
that
a little true? Bit. There's a little bit of bullying in there. There's a little bit of pursuing your dreams in there. Like my school talk is called You Is Good. And it's about that, you know, your ideas are worth sharing. And I clarify, right? I say your ideas are worth sharing, your dreams are worth pursuing, and your example is worth setting. And then I clarify, mm-hmm. I'm like, well, your constructive ideas are worth sharing. And your positive, your productive passions are worth pursuing,
right?
And your positive, your healthy example is worth setting,
right?
Because I was actually in session at Rosedale Traditional School in Rosedale, like these middle school kids, and I was saying the idea of your dreams are worth pursuing. But that morning when I got to the school, everything smelled like fart, like, and it's like, if you know Chilliwack smells like fart because it's all farmland and people are spreading manure and whatever else. And so it's like, what's going on? Like, who wanted the school to smell like the outside of the school? Some kid had sprayed, it's called ass spray. Like, he'd sprayed the whole, like, the hallways with this butt spray.
And that was his dream?
And that was his dream. And so then, actually, funny, as I was doing
Clips
my...
said I could.
No, but as I was doing my talk, I clarified, because I'm like, one of you walked to school today and your dream was to make your school stink. So I'm like, let's clarify what dreams are. They're productive passions that are going to have a positive impact on the people around you. So, and what I'm saying, guys, is don't spray butt spray.
Don't hijack my message.
Yeah.
to create the smell of methane.
But this guy's choice to stink up his whole school clarified my talk and made me adjust it so that I was clearer as to what it is that I'm challenging kids to do.
So really, it was in the final analysis a productive thing that he did.
I am so thankful that he stank up the school that day.
Did you hire him to go to other schools and stink up the schools beforehand?
I do it myself.
I do
it myself and I put it on kids because I don't have to pay a kid to spray.
Exactly. I was
going to
say you have to pay them every time.
Yeah. I can keep my costs.
Child labor laws.
I can keep my costs down by just sneaking in earlier. And
I can see that you're a good businessman. You're thinking about different packages to sell to clients. You don't hire children anymore.
No.
You're really improving.
Not because I care about the welfare of children. No. I don't want to have to pay them.
You care about your welfare.
Exactly.
And maybe the welfare of your own children. I don't know if that factors in or not.
Yeah. Yeah, I feed them.
You do.
When they're good.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Make them some eggs every once in a while.
Super good. No, cool. But I do, like, I love, and this is maybe you say, what's my favorite thing to do? I love being able to use comedy and then also take some of the more poignant, more serious things that I think are important and to pair those things together. So it's why I really love emceeing, especially these nonprofit events, because then I get to take comedy and what I enjoy doing, and then I put it together with being able to, you know, encourage someone in their passion. And then the same thing with school. And then the thing I got to do just this last Friday was I went and I did Pro D at a school, Robert Bateman High School in Abbotsford, and I did the Pro D. So I did a keynote, talked for about an hour about the idea of, like, overcoming fear, you know, and how all of us, we have this life passions, but then we all have fear. We all have these things that hold us back. And what do we have to do to overcome this fear? And so I got to do that keynote, and then we did, like, Medium is the Message. We did a bunch of interactive activities and exercises, you know, to develop cooperation and to, you know, to face our fears of, you know, being in front of people or looking stupid in front of. And the session is called The Power of Looking Stupid. And I tell a lot of personal stories about looking stupid, which is how I make my living now, is looking stupid in front of people. but the reality is I still care, right? I still care what people think about me. I go and do auditions and I don't get picked. Right? Do 60 auditions, you get picked for three.
Yeah.
And it's like, what is it that keeps you going back? Why do you keep facing your fears? Why do you get on the radio when maybe you don't know whether or not you have anything to say? Or, you know, why do you pick up your guitar and stand in front of people? It's like, well, what if people don't like me? You know? And the thing is that the main point, like, I've got a bunch of different points, but the main point is that the reason why you're doing what you're doing has got to be bigger than yourself. Right. If it's just about you, if it's just about the check that I'm going to get, if it's just about people thinking that I'm good, well, then that's not good enough. You're going to, when you fail, it's going to suck. Maybe you succeed, but then how empty is that? And so it's got to be about other people. It's got to be about a bigger cause, faith. It's got to be serving. The best advice I ever got doing stand-up comedy is, like, if you expect anything from your audience, you've lost. You know, it's like your job.
Right.
Is
they don't owe you anything.
They don't owe you anything.
Right. I think about, like, all those moments where somebody comes off stage like, oh, these guys suck.
They suck. It's like, I don't know what you're probably like from the stage even. That was gold. I don't know what's wrong with you guys.
What's wrong with you guys? It's interesting. I've talked on the show before. I was talking to David Ward, who's a musician, but we were talking about the language around between performers and audience. And I mentioned, and particularly when it comes to stand-up comedians, how the language can be quite adversarial. I murdered them. I killed them. And I was speculating at the time. I was like, well, I guess that's because there's kind of an underlying belief that you're going to battle with them, which is what you're saying. It's like, maybe they don't owe you anything. Maybe you're not at battle. Maybe it's just, here's your microphone. Here's your stage. What do you want to do?
Yeah.
You know, but I think it's kind of maybe like a way to cope with the terror of that by kind of like getting your back up against the wall and going in with your arms thrashing or something.
Totally. Well, if you want to talk about violent occupations, my wife's a photographer. And so it's like she goes to shoot. She's going to shoot the children, you know, and then she frames them and then she hangs them on the wall. So anyway. That's a joke I have, but I tell it better when I'm actually performing it.
When you're standing.
Yeah, when I'm really, it's a really good, what's wrong with you guys? Why aren't you laughing at home?
Maybe they are. You don't know. That's the thing about the radio is we're sitting here and you're thinking that just bombed, but for all you know, that was the best joke you ever told and the best execution, according to my listenership, which is very limited, by the way.
Execution, you just said. That's another violence. They weren't laughing, I know, because no one's calling in to say that was a great
joke. But if they're laughing, they don't have time. Even if they wanted to dial, they'd be mashing at the keypad because, like you said, the snot's coming out.
Oh, my gosh.
Think about that.
They're loving it. Why is this not a call-in show? Why, is there a call-in show?
It could be. Do you want to call in and talk to Cliff? You can. 604-UBC-CITR. If you're listening to the podcast after the fact, that is not an option, to be clear. But if you are listening to the radio show live, and by the way, you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM. I'm your host, Jeff Bryant. This is Now We're Talking. And in studio is Cliff Bryant. You can talk to him right now by dialing 604-UBC-CITR. That's 604-822-2487. Cliff has expressed a wish for this to be a call-in show. And why not? There is no reason.
There
why
is no reason.
Be.
I didn't even know. I didn't even know that was an option.
It absolutely is an option.
It got
and we
super...
put it on the table. And there's still time enough left to do it. We've got some more things we want to talk about, of course.
For sure. Well, and the thing I want to do, too, is that if for some reason you are listening to the podcast, like this is after the fact,
sure.
and you want to talk to the host of the show, I'll give you his cell number right now.
Here we go.
It's 778.
778.
No, I'm not doing it. I can't do that.
Can't do that.
It could be.
I was curious how many digits you were going to get.
318. Okay.
778-318.
And I won't
Wait
tell
a minute.
This.
That's my number.
I know. That's what I'm doing.
Okay. I don't like this game anymore.
I'm not going to do it.
I'm like, as you're saying this, I'm reaching around for like the radio guy button that's like whoa, like an explosion.
Yeah,
or
yeah.
like a chicken squawking or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Cliff, we don't have that much time. We have some time left in the show.
Okay.
Don't get me wrong, but you see how time flies, and there's other things I want to ask you about. There's so much we could talk about, but I know that you were in a car accident in October.
Oh my gosh,
can we talk a little bit about that?
Because can we talk about that?
Because I was reading your blog where you described that experience.
Uh-huh.
And I was just curious, having an going through something like that, I wondered how that impacted you.
Well,
because it's relatively recent. I mean, it's just a few months ago.
It was October 28th.
Yeah.
I'm still figuring out the insurance stuff. It's great. It's my favorite thing. But no, I was heading westbound on the highway, left lane, going to a lunch meeting with a guy who got me a gig, a friend of mine that he referred me for a corporate gig. And I was just, you know, going to take him out for lunch to say thank you. I didn't make it to the lunch appointment. Guy came right into my lane. You know, and I avoided the collision,
mm-hmm.
and wasn't able to get control of the car again. So I pulled left, which would have, you know, which puts me on the shoulder of the road. But then I accelerated and went past him, and I tried to pull back in the lane, and I went across the lane into another lane. No collisions yet. I thought for sure I had it pulled around straight. And then I got tagged on my back end, and that turned me careening towards the median. I hit the median head on, flipped over.
The vehicle flipped.
The vehicle. This is what they tell me.
Did you lose consciousness?
I did not lose consciousness. There was a crash, and then of course the airbag came up, so there was like a bit of a blank spot there when everything kind of
sure.
came at you.
Sure.
And I ended up upside down in the median. So, and then first thing I'm thinking is like, get out of this car.
Right.
Who knows, I'm going to explode.
Right.
So I
away from the danger.
I clicked the seatbelt to get out because I was hanging upside down, and I kind of crunched my head on the top of the car, and then I lay on my back. And I found out afterwards, do not unclip your seatbelt. You're supposed to just hang there until someone
How could
come.
You know that?
Yeah, yeah. No, I know it now. But
yeah.
I had no brakes. I had no cuts, no bleeding. I had some scrapes.
The greatest injury was the unbuckling of the seatbelt and the head.
And the head is like, why is my head somewhere on top?
Oh my God.
it was pretty insane. They came. The guy who cut me off, like, didn't cut me off. He came right at me, beside me, came and held my neck. He was an off-duty firefighter, and he's like, hi, I'm a firefighter. Sorry for coming into your lane. Just stay still. He asked me all kinds of questions, and
to help you keep consciousness.
Just to keep consciousness. And then I'm like, were you the one that hit me too? Like, did you tag me on my back end? And then he stopped talking. Like, and so it's funny because he was so nice and so helpful. And I got to be honest, I'm so thankful for him. But since then, he hasn't come out. He hasn't.
Because of legal concerns?
No, his testimony is protected by the police. And so we're you know, just trying to get him to step forward and say, I swerved in this guy's lane.
Wow.
And it's not happening.
Talk about a confusion of roles for him to be the
gosh.
Supportive person, but at the same time thinking, oh, maybe I should watch what I say right now.
Totally. But yeah, no, anyway, it doesn't matter. The point is, though, this happened. This is 3 days before my 40th birthday. So many helpful people. Paramedic was awesome. Hospital nurse was awesome. You know, the x-ray techs were, and nothing was broken. The only thing was just a lot of soft tissue damage in my back just from being thrown around in the car.
Sure.
But this is right before my busiest season ever in my in the history of my career.
Wow.
I took
Christmas holiday party
Christmas
season.
Holidays parties and fundraisers. And November 4th, I was on stage at Hotel Vancouver doing Central City Brewing's Night for Autism. And this is through, like, this is what, 28th, that's 5 days, seven days.
Less than a week.
I can't do math.
It feels like about a week.
And that was the first of, you know, 20+ events.
So you got right back in the swing.
I got right back. And I was like, well, through insurance, I can reclaim all the money. Like, I can cancel all the gigs and tell everyone how much I was going to make. And then they would have paid me all the things. But I was just like, you know what? I've got to do this. I've got to do these gigs because this is the future of my, you know, my corporate comedy career. If I don't show up to all of these events, as understanding as so many people would probably be, it's like, you know, I don't have the opportunity to make these people laugh and show them that I can do this. So I sucked it up, served the clients as best as I could, and everything went well. There was one event that I was doing. It was for a construction company, a development company. And I came in and I roasted all their staff, gave gifts as Santa Claus. I don't do that. I don't normally do dress up. It's not my favorite thing to do. But they said, Cliff, would you come and like give our staff gifts out as Santa? And these guys have booked me for other things. I'm like, yeah, for sure. I'll do whatever you want me to do. And then I came back as myself and I did 20 minutes of stand up. And then this is what I got super excited about. It. They wanted me to referee their White Elephant gift exchange. So there's 50 people in there. Everyone's brought a gift, and they do the whole like, you know, take the gift off the counter, and then you can steal from the other people. That whole game.
Okay.
And apparently last year there was almost a fight between some of the like coworkers because it was like an alcohol package, of course, and they didn't want that to happen. They wanted it to be fun this year. So I was the referee, and that was so much fun. So instead of them being mad at each other, they were just mad at me as I harassed them. But the dance, there was a dance afterwards too, and I brought the DJ. And so, I was going to wait. I wanted to go home, but I was going to hang out there. And my back was burning so bad. Like, this is now.
You were dancing?
No, I wasn't dancing. I'd just done all these things. I was on my feet for that long of a time, which isn't a long time, in for a normal human being.
Yeah.
But my back was messed. Yeah. And so.
You wouldn't have chosen to stand that
time
if you were at
home. My back was burning so bad. Wow. And there was a window to the outside. And people were drunk and dancing, and I just like, you know what? I just lifted my shirt, and I put my back up against the window. My friend Simon Bridgefoot, he's a DJ. He just was staring at me. He's like, you're crazy.
You're cooling off your back.
I was just cooling off my back, and it's all taped up. It's got all that, like, you know, the Olympian tape on it from my physio and chiro and all that stuff. Then they tape me up and make sure that my muscles are supported and all that stuff. And then I was just shirt up on the back on the window. Not very professional, but at the same time, at that point, night, and everyone's out of their minds.
They probably just thought it was your own version of partying.
They're like, this guy is having so much fun.
This guy doesn't mess around when it comes to partying.
Take off your tops. But no, I survived the season. And
the car accident itself. I mean, we've kind of gotten into the season, but I'm curious about like surviving that experience. Was there, I know that you're a person of faith, but I'm curious to know having that, whether it's the moment the crash is happening or in the immediate aftermath when you're kind of in shock, did it cause you to have thoughts about your own mortality and to check in with yourself and what your life is for and all those kinds of questions?
Yeah, I still get a little verklempt when I think about it.
Sure.
Being in the hospital room too, like I'm making jokes with the nurse. Jokes with the nurse.
That's what I do.
But my wife is there. You know, my wife comes and so we're laughing and having a good time. And then there's a moment of quiet when the nurse and I look at her and we hold hands, you know, and we cry. You know, because it's like their whole like her and I'm like, for me to die is not a big deal, but for her to be a mom with our kids and you know, and so then it's like you don't think about what you're missing because you're just like you're just not there, right?
Yeah.
But to think of for my children to have to grow up without a dad and all those things, and so I'm feeling all those things now again.
Heavy.
As we talk about it, and then we watched Pete's Dragon last night. Have you guys watched Pete's? Have you guys? There's only just Jeff here.
Well, the audience can call in.
Oh yeah,
if you've seen Pete's Dragon, you can call us.
Call
at
it and tell us if you've
UBC
seen
CITR.
So the opening,
I haven't seen it.
The opening scene of Pete's Dragon. Dragon, just to give you this little piece of it, and it's not giving away the movie, it's just giving away the first little bit of the season, see movie scenes. They're driving on the highway, you know, and they're reading the story, and he's like, what's an adventure? And it's like, well, this is what we're on right now. And like the dad looks back and smiles, and the mom's like, you're the bravest little boy ever. But all of a sudden, a deer runs in front of the car, and the car flips. And I immediately go back to that place. So it's like
triggered.
So I'm triggered right now. Get a grip, Cliff. So you have this boy, you know, on the side of the road, and he's now has to live his life on his own. But thankfully, there was a dragon in the woods that raised him for 6 years.
Otherwise, you would have lost your stuff.
Oh, I lost my stuff. It's like at one point, the kids were like, Dad, are you crying? I'm like, I've been crying for the last hour.
Just at like a low volume, just a consistent low tearfulness.
Oh, have you seen the trailer for Wonder?
No.
Oh my gosh. Julia Roberts. I don't know who the dad is in the movie. I can't remember who the kid, but it's like, this kid, I don't remember his name, but his face is malformed, I'm going to say. And so it's about him kind of like going into school and integrating with friends and all that stuff and just the challenges he has. It's just a very emotional, beautiful story of friendship and all that stuff. And so I watched the trailer and it's like 30 seconds and my wife is like, what are you watching? Because I'm like, because when I get really emotional, I'm trying to keep the crying in. I'm like, right. I just squeak.
The emotion trying to get out of any orifice it can, you know, through your skin, maybe through your mouth or your ears or your eyes.
Those are also my bedroom sounds. I just had to throw that in there.
Your wife is like, did you have to share that piece? I thought that was for us, honey.
I thought you were a clean comedian. It's like, no, but it's all. I'm also a reality comedian.
And you're going through this process, this 40-year process, as the future listener knows, of devolving into vile filth. Cliff, I'm looking at the time. We don't have a lot of time left. I'm glad that you've come in, but I'm knowing, looking at my Cliff notes here, in fact, and I'm knowing that September the 7th, dad body of work. Is that a thing?
Yeah.
Okay. So make sure that you tell me a bit about that and plug that in case people are thinking, this Cliff guy, it sounds like he's emotionally repressed. I respect that. I want to see him perform in September.
I'm so emotionally aware. That's the problem. I'm very in tune with it.
I know, they miscalculate. A lot of these listeners, they get it all wrong.
It's hard to interpret what's happening. He says he does clean comedy, then he made like a weird orgasm.
That's why they want to come and see you, so they can try to get to the bottom of
you
this.
You never know what happens. I do try to be in the moment. I will be faithful to what's happening in my brain. I'm filming all my jokes. I'm filming all my jokes. So I've got the GW Graham Theater rented. It's a beautiful 350-seat theater.
Cool.
And I've got...
In Chilliwack. Cool.
Yeah, it's Sardis area. It's actually, you know what? If you drive on the highway, it doesn't take you long to get there. It's worth it. It's worth the toll, guys. And so I've got Ed Hill. He's a Coquitlam based. He was once Georgia Straits, you know, top comic to watch in Vancouver.
Cool.
He's one of my guests. My friend Jenny Taves is going to tell some jokes as well. She's hilarious. What I'm going to say, $10 and you get to watch a show, and then I'll try and sell you on actually downloading the album afterwards too.
And so it'll be an audio album as well as a video?
Yeah. Well, I haven't even thought about the audio yet, but I'll film it.
And have you done that before?
I've produced shows before that have been filmed. Yeah. For sure.
But what about your own stand-up thing?
I haven't done the full set yet, and I've never been the headliner of my own show.
Good for you.
I've been a variety act, you know, in my own shows. This is the time. I'm going for it.
Quite the adventure from it was approximately 5 years ago. It was June 2012. So I'm going to say basically 5 years ago, you and I doing that one day workshop, trying desperately through repeated emails to get a functional, useful income tax receipt for tax purposes,
that's all we wanted.
Failing. And 5 years later, look at you. You're doing the show. You're filming it. I like it, man. I think, you know, you and I have had the chance to check in here and there. Sometimes I think we've met up a couple times. We're auditioning and stuff like that. It's been too long. And I love the excuse to see people that I consider good friends, even though we haven't connected in a while. And I love the stuff that you're doing because for me, it really inspires me to... Yeah, keep hanging in there, creating things, putting yourself out there and seeing what can happen. And I think by not seeing you in a while, it's quite impressive all the things that have happened for you. So it makes me happy.
That's kind of you to say. And Jeff, I said it to you earlier, I have a lot of respect for your intentionality. So
thanks,
you care about people, you want to ask real questions, and I hope you guys keep listening to the show because Jeff's the real deal. And if you've never heard him play music, you should, you know, follow him on Instagram and listen to his clips that he shares and go to his shows and
how can I
stuff.
Not take this and now use this as the promo for my show? This is just like a very clever way for you to infiltrate the show promo that I should have for Now We're Talking.
You know when you have like, you say, he's the real Jeff Bryant, you think it's like, oh, is Jeff Bryant official? No, he's the real Jeff, he's real, he's a real guy. He's real.
That's, you know, love that's it. That's the wordplay that evolved. Initially, I just thought it was like I lamented. I feel like Cliff Prang, I don't think there's a million of those out there. I
Not
feel like
lot.
That's a name that you can Google it. It's going to be you. Jeff Bryan, it's kind of common enough that you're going to get a lot of returns. So my initial impetus behind it was just a cheeky way of saying, yeah, there's a lot of Googleable Jeff Bryans, but this is the one that you want. But it's funny that you say that, because for me at some point I was like, I don't know if I'm ever going to achieve this, but I actually, in terms of putting myself out there, want to represent myself in a genuine way. So you're the first person that's ever noticed the duality of that, and you deserve some sort of prize. I'm going to have to consider what that is. I don't have one. I'm not a typical morning radio DJ with a prize to give you. But I'm sure
I'll take your shirt. That's a sweet shirt.
I'll give you my shirt.
I'll take the shirt.
And you can see how badly I burned
it. I also want your voice. Your voice is like butter.
Is it?
It's like deep butter.
Has it been buttery during the show?
Well, it's so deep and rich.
Oh boy. Folks, I'm going to take my shirt off as soon as we get off the air.
It's getting real.
And there's going to be some buttery voice action. Cliff, thanks for coming in. That's
thanks
all the time
me.
We have, and we'll see you next week, folks.
Love you.